I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your well-being, the well-being of our communities, of our society, and the ecological balance of planet Earth. I'm a long-standing reporter on health, the environment, food, the media, public policy, and the new progressive wave that is sweeping the country to kind of help uplift and kind of step a little further than the kind of slightly wan Democratic Party. There are some good people in that party, but, you know, there are a lot of people who like the far more vicious and vociferous Republican elected officials are also, in a sense, beholden to corporate donors and therefore not taking the more successful and aggressive and progressive efforts that we really need to turn around our current situation. Over the last few weeks, we've been talking in several programs about the Kavanaugh nomination and the role of women, and this begins what I hope will be a series over the next month as we head into the midterm elections, talking about the progressive opportunity for turning our country around with journalists as well as people running for office. And it's a great opportunity to listen to and get a sense of progressives all across the country. And we'll be launching that today with a terrific candidate from Washington State named Sarah Smith. And we're going to be talking about the progressive wave with Sarah as well as her own region and candidacy. And one thing I want to say to listeners of the show is, you know, the Republican side has been so successful, A, because they have a lot of money, B, because they really organize and work together. And, you know, what we have tended more to do on the left liberal side in many locations is merely think about our locality. Who is running for office in my district, in my state? All of that, of course, is important. That's part of the grassroots. That's the place to begin. But that should not mean that we kind of keep our heads down ostrich-like, because we can not only learn from other leaders and elected officials and people running for office throughout the country, but we can also contribute by our volunteer labor, our donations to people anywhere in the country, because it's not just our sole locality. I know a lot of people know this, but some haven't really thought it through. It's not just our sole locality that determines, for example, the composition of the Senate and who is in the majority or minority role, as we've just borne witness to over the last several weeks. It's not just in our locality that we, you know, just go to the vote on election day, as important and essential as that is, and determine, you know, who represents our region. Really, we have to be vested in what's going on all throughout the country, and that's why, and participate all throughout the country, not as bystanders, and get involved. And so that's going to be our theme for the next month through the midterms. I am delighted on today's show to bring to listeners a leading-edge progressive candidate from Washington State District 9. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Sarah Smith.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, you know, your campaign is so cool, and I think one of the things that's really important for people everywhere is to readjust our sense of who should be an elected official and who should be in public office. People are accustomed to seeing a white male, slickly dressed, with a certain amount of, you know, a certain look that they have to them, the blue tie or whatever. And, you know, even though that is what has, through, you know, years and decades of over-familiarization and normalizing of that kind of representation, has come to mean, you know, who looks like a candidate to us, who we think would serve in office. And that really needs to change, because these are the people that have kind of, on both sides of the aisle, been holding hands to take corporate money and really, you know, not act on the will of the you know, of the majority of people in this country, and it's gone along for a long time and is getting out of hand. And so one of the things I really love about your candidacy is that, you know, you're a younger person, you are working class, you are coming up to run for office through your own experiences personally and through your work vocationally. And I love the way you also, you know, speak from your working class background and to working class people. Could you acquaint our listeners a little bit more of who you are and where you're coming from?
Sure, absolutely. I'd love to. So I'm 30 years old. I am a working class woman. I worked full time through college. I've been working since I was 15. I've been on my own since I was 17. And I've had a number of different jobs in my lifetime. So I've worked at a bakery. I've worked at the GameStop. I've worked as tech support for Verizon. I worked for a major insurance company. I did mortgage assistance for people experiencing foreclosure at the height of the recession. I helped with bankruptcy right after the recession was beginning to ebb a little bit and people were using bankruptcy as a crutch to support themselves again. And I was helping to manage a mechanic garage for the first part of my campaign, and now I have a job full-time, too, while I'm doing the campaign where I just research tax laws. The thing that I think people don't really 100% give them credit for is working class people, people like me in my position who haven't started a nonprofit or solved world hunger or been able to take no salary for 10 years while we did something else. We're told all the time that we can't afford politics, that we're not allowed in. You talked about that whole image of the politician, the whole older white gentleman in a suit. And that's kind of what that conjures, but it's a way of keeping working class people out of the system that's designed to govern their lives. And a big theme of this campaign for me is we eschew that image completely. We are not that figure. I wear t-shirts with blazers. I don't cut my hair the way I was told to. I don't do my makeup the way I was supposed to, because that's not who I am, and that's not who most people are. And one of the things that's been important to me about my candidacy is to emphasize to people that your lived experience is enough. Your lived experience, your 9-to-5, your Monday through Friday, makes you worthy of running for office to represent the people like you who live in your area. Everybody who wants to serve in public office is worthy because they live in the public, they experience the public, they are the public. We are the ones who are on the receiving ends of these laws. We are the ones who understand the lens through which legislation should be seen. Because what might look like something that you can compromise on to an older white man, you might not be able to compromise on to a single working mother of two. And the only way that they will know that is if we have that single mother of two in office representing other single mothers of two like her, who understand what we can and cannot live without. So that's been a big theme of my candidacy, a big theme of my campaign, is just empowering working people to recognize we get to decide who our representatives are. Experience makes us worthy.
That is so true and so important and powerful. And, you know, the other thing that's so that's been so amazing about this time is that, you know, I would say, you know, white people, men and women, you know, have been used to being the ones in the lead. And that this is a time where, you know, we've kind of run things into the ground, you know. So we're now in a situation where all three branches of government have been locked down, you know, under, you know, extremely right-wing control and, you know, with a takedown of all of the liberties and programs and initiatives that created, you know, a solid, fair society to whatever degree we were able to, you know, for some people, but really disadvantaged a lot of people. And so our sense that we have to be in charge and this is what a leader looks like and this is who should be leading, you know, we're accustomed to it from years of privilege and involvement. But in fact, it's really young people. It's people of color. It's people from different populations that really are surging forward and taking the lead. And I think that it's really essential and important and a gift, really, also from this kind of false sense of entitlement for people to step back. You know, some are, you know, standing up. I think women need to make their voices heard. But I also think that younger people and people of color need to step forward, and some of us need to step back and support them rather than expressing in every instance our own creativity or whatever we think would be the primary thing to do. And it's hard when, you know, you've had a life of privilege, you know, relative privilege compared to many people in this country, many people all around the world, to really get the message and to do that and to, you know, you can have talked about change in some way your whole life, but not really be as capable of it as we need to be in this time. So, you know, I am so thrilled to have you, Sarah, on the show, and also to encourage people, you know, if you have the time, if you have the wherewithal, if you're concerned about what's going on in our government, as I think most people are and should be, you know, one thing we can do is participate in the midterm elections beginning today and make it a priority to participate and, you know, and to support candidates like Sarah and the other candidates will be presenting, you know, over the next month. Get involved and do it. And find progressive groups to do it too with, because they'll have the right priorities with, you know, some Democratic outlets, Indivisible or whatever. We've seen the weakness in organizing on the Democratic side. So, you know, you don't keep repeating the same mistakes over and over just because that's what you're familiar with. And so we're trying to kind of disrupt that and show people a new direction on this show. Sarah, are you able to give us a sense of your district and the kind of people you're addressing there and what you see as, like, the primary issues, you know, the main issues?
Sure. So my district is extremely unique. We are very diverse. We speak 160 languages in my whole district. We also have one of the worst displays of wealth inequality of all the districts in the state. We have the wealthiest areas, which are like Mercer Island, and then we have some areas like Bellevue that are more upper class, upper middle class. And then we swing down into some of the lower income areas like South Seattle and Kent, and then we go into suburbs of Federal Way and the north part of Tacoma. But we are, we're considered a majority-minority district, so we have a majority of people of color that live in this district. And we're extremely diverse. We are extremely passionate. And one of the things that we did very early on in the campaign is, because we have been campaigning for about 18 months now, so we had some time to try some things. We started doing canvassings in different cities around the district to kind of, because it's such an interesting, diverse place, we wanted to get a better sense of what the biggest issues were in people's minds. And the things that tie everybody together in this district are, we are all concerned about campaign finance reform. That, hands down, is getting big money out of politics is the number one thing that gets people to open their doors to us. And then we have people that are really concerned about income inequality. And then we also have folks that are really, really concerned about housing affordability. So those are probably going to be some of the three biggest things. But it varies depending on where you go a little bit. But that's probably the three majority things we hear the most. Campaign finance reform and public financing of elections, though, is absolutely number one.
Now, let me ask you a question. In the field of your opponents whom you're running against, how does your stance on the issues you just mentioned differ from the positions taken by your opponent or opponents?
A lot. So it's just myself versus a 22-year incumbent Democrat, and he is in favor of corporate money, has no problem with corporate money in politics, has gone so far as to say it does not influence votes in Congress, and he is wrong. And what's sad is if it were him 22 years ago, in 1996, when he first took office, he actually was so dedicated to getting campaign finance reform put in that he didn't take corporate money for the first year. And then he actually became Washington State's third highest recipient of PAC money and suddenly changed his mind on whether or not PAC money influenced votes. And I think he's wrong, but that's one of the areas on which he and I differ enormously. Income inequality, he called a considerable problem in this district. I think it's an absolute and utter travesty and moral failure on our leadership that we have the kind of income inequality that we do in this district. It is ridiculous. And after 22 years of his leadership in office, The district hasn't gotten better, it's gotten worse. Unless you're a CEO or a millionaire, the state of things for people who are middle class, who are working class, who are poor, it has gotten worse for us. And so I take much bolder stances on ways to fix income inequality. He wants to raise taxes across the board on all people. I think raising taxes on people who can't afford it, like working moms, like single parents, like newlyweds trying to start their lives, like kids who are just getting out the door to go to college, I think raising their taxes is wrong. I think we should raise them on the people who can bear the burden, the billionaire class and the corporate class. That is who needs to have their taxes paid, not the working people of this country. And then housing affordability. Well, for starters, I have a plan to address it. That's one of the major ways that he and I differ on housing and housing affordability. But we take bold stances. I talk all the time about a housing for all plan, which is investment in 10 million social homes over 10 years. And when you couple that with something like a federal jobs guarantee, you can now expand what that means, which is amazing. So we'd be paying people directly good wages for good work to build affordable houses from coast to coast in areas that are hit the hardest and that need it the most. And we can also turn some of those social homes into senior housing. And if it's a federal jobs guarantee, we can pay staff directly who can staff these facilities, who can keep them high quality and maintain them. But we have a lot of opportunity to house folks. And the difference between me and my incumbent is that I have a plan to address it.
You know, this sounds absolutely terrific. And, you know, one of my questions is to you, people on the coasts and in, you know, blue state areas tend to regard, and in fact it has been a problem, that some working class people have been influenced, organized, and sort of pointed down the wrong road. Where the economic pressures in the very areas that you're talking about have kind of driven people, instead of, you know, to sort of flee any kind of, you know, and want to reject any kind of government program, and instead, you know, the solution offered to them, which many follow, and this is particularly true for some working class Americans, is, you know, someone else of a different color took your job, you know. And so then this breeds this divisiveness and resentment, and, you know, in the name of government, you know, intervening to help people has been given a bad jacket. You know, how do you talk to working class people about these kinds of issues? What do you find when you talk to them? Are you hearing that, and how do you talk to them, or is, in fact, this is some kind of misperception on the part of,
I think it kind of depends on where you go. So here in Washington, we don't really so much have as much of that animosity towards people for taking our jobs. There's a different kind of tension in Seattle. But as far as work itself goes, a lot of folks are just tired, and there's so much going on that they don't even stop to think and consider that stuff. So it kind of is a little different up here. We still have a lot of that racial tension. Do not be mistaken. We actually have a lot more than people perceive in our state, which is, it's really unfortunate. But because we're supposed to be an incredibly progressive state, but I could take a whole podcast on that on its own. But we don't have so much that same tension. But I can tell you, when I lived in Arizona, I got that tension all the time. It's a red state, and I watched it in people I knew who were blaming people of color, and, you know, Hispanic folks who were coming across the border legally, that they're doing work out in the field, they're doing a lot of field work, and they are expressing animosity towards these people, talking about them taking their jobs. And I kind of had to look at one of my friends one day, and I'm like, he's not taking your job. No one's taking your job. And I mean, the thing to keep in mind for people who are experiencing that is you just got to tell them no one's taken a job. They're given a job. And the person that gives them that job isn't you. It's not your boss. It's your boss's boss's boss. It's that person that has made that decision to do that. And they want us to sit at the ground in these working class jobs, and they want us to sit on the ground level and pit us against each other. And the easiest way for them to get us to identify one another is by our skin color. And so that's what they do. They pit us against each other based on skin color, so we're only standing at the bottom pointing at each other and not where the problem exists, which is at the top of the executive board. That is where we need to be pointing. That is how we get workers justice. That is how we get people justice. And that is how we get working class
class folks justice of all races. Because when we elevate our fellow coworkers of color, when we elevate our communities of color, everybody benefits, everybody wins in a society where equity is possible for all workers across the board. But we need to make sure that we're bringing those folks of color with us. We need to make sure that we are bringing those Hispanic folks who just want to do work with us. Otherwise, it is not true economic justice when we go after those folks at the top.
Mm-hmm. That makes complete sense. You know, about the Citizens United question and the fact that your opponent doesn't see a problem. And, you know, it's a really kind of poignant thing that he began as someone decrying this. And then a year later, you know, when he got an opportunity to be bought in, he went with it, and now he denies there's a problem. This kind of thing has made a lot of people quite cynical about politics. And so they're kind of like, you know, the only solution they see is that either, you know, all politicians on all sides of the aisle are terrible, and we just drop out, or else, you know, the Democratic Party, you know, ordinary establishment Democrats, at least, you know, in lip service, if not in actual policy change, are more favorable to the diversity that is core to the American society, and are, you know, and are inclined to, you know, not be so viciously attacking toward women and our rights. You know, these are the differentials, and they're significant and important ones. But we still have this buy-in to, you know, our elected officials being bought and selling us out. And in the minds of many people, you know, this has been normalized. This is just the way it is. Anybody would do it. A progressive, if elected, you know, and tempted in that way, would do it. That's just human nature. I'd love to hear from you about, you know, your vision of why the new wave of leading-edge progressives are different than that. So
Oh, no, of course. I mean, so this is kind of, this is, especially for me, it's very near and dear to my heart, because I think it's, we're coming from a different place when we look at politics. And you kind of see something like this with young people in the workplace now, actually, because I know a lot of progressives are 35 or under right now. But we are, a lot of progressives running for office, I should say, are 35 or under. But we are coming out of a different lived experience. And this is why I keep bringing up that lived experience. We're coming out of a post-recession America where our college funds were gambled and lost with, our futures were gambled and lost with, where everything our parents wanted to build for us and leave for us and give to us is gone because of Wall Street. And they got bailed out and they got to walk away scot-free. So we are used to, we're the generation that's used to work. And we're used to being broke. We're used to not having enough money. And so when we see this offer of money before us, it's easier for us to resist it because we know that we have other things to do and we can do and can't accomplish without it. And one of the big things to realize is you're seeing it in the workplace where there's a big study done that shows young people will actually leave a job for one that pays them less if they feel like the work they're doing is more meaningful. And I think that says a lot about what about the next generation of leadership, especially within the Democratic Party and within the progressive movement itself. We are willing to step away from money and funds and everything because we recognize that it is more important to do something meaningful than something that gives you a ton of cash if it's empty. And this idea of legislating on an empty soul is not appealing to us anymore. And so these temptations of money, these attempts at bribery, these moments where people say, oh, come over here, I'll give you all this money to do this, we're actually saying, we know how to do it right. We know how to do it without you. We're not afraid of losing that money, and we understand why this legislation is necessary now. We are not willing to gamble with other working class people's lives. Working class folks, I am directly impacting my family. I'm directly impacting my friends. And so an offer of money to get me to sell out my heart to my soul in order to leave them in the dust is not appealing to me. because I've lived their experience, because I've worked their experience, because I've been stuck on the same stretch of 405 as the people that I live right next to, because it's real people in my life who are going to be affected by it. It's easy for me to look at that money and say, I would not feel good about taking that money and eschewing these people and leaving them in the dirt again. And that's unique to, I think, a lot of the progressives within the progressive movement, is we're really here because we believe in what we do, and we believe in the corrupting force of money, and we believe that we can be better without it, and we are so committed to that belief that we're running our whole campaigns without it, which, trust me, is so hard. And if I'm going to go through this and do all this hard work, but I'm going to do it the right way, I'm going to take it and run with it in my candidacy and in my servanthood to the people around me. That's something that I've worked so hard at that I'm going to hold on to, because that's what keeps my soul intact. That's what keeps that piece of my soul there. Not the money from oil companies that's going to take it away, not the money from big war that's going to take it away, but I would rather do something meaningful and be broke all the time than make all the money in the world to ruin the people around me.
That's a really different orientation, and, you know, a beautiful and wonderful one, you know, from the prior generations, where it was my happiness and success at any cost, you know, and yep. The condition of the world begins with how I feel, and, you know, may then incrementally goes out from there, you know, and maybe it will never actually get to how the society or the earth are functioning, because, you know, I'm still working on you know, taking care of myself. I mean, that was really a model that was very instilled, mm-hmm. even in the, you know, more political and you know, left-oriented boomer generation. So this represents a real change. And I think it's really that shift in value set that puts progressives in the lead, young progressives in the lead, and the rest of us who have been conditioned otherwise need to really learn from, follow, and support what you're doing. Who do you see as, in, you know, in your state, like, who are the constituencies that are really hearing the message, being inspired, and, you know, taking a stand to participate and support you as you create this opportunity for them?
So we kind of have a broad spectrum of folks, actually. I mean, it's pretty cool because it's pretty indicative of how our district is such a wide swath of different lived experience and livelihoods. We largely have a really young volunteer team, so there are people that are around my age. And then we have some older folks that come in and volunteer, and one of them mans our front office, and she is amazing. But we have a bunch of different socioeconomic brackets. We have some people that are only making $35,000 a year, and we have some people that are six-figure earners on our team. But everybody that has joined on our team that has helped us bring this message out into the community, they've been really, really successful, especially in lower income areas. We've been really successful in engaging those people. Working class areas, we've been very successful engaging all those people. And then we actually, if we go into some of the higher earner parts of our district, we actually have a lot of support there. And I think that that's something people need to realize, is if someone identifies as upper middle class, that doesn't mean that they don't love the people that are in the working class so much that they don't want to pay more money. A lot of these folks want to help elevate everyone. And we're really finding those people, and we're tapping into that, and we're getting them engaged and letting them know they have a place in our movement. They're part of this movement with us. And so it's really is an everybody in, nobody out movement. And that's what I keep trying to tell people. But we've got people who are, I have a woman who's amazing, and she's a full-time caretaker for someone with a disability, so she can't volunteer out in the streets canvassing. But she's phone banking from home. And I have some folks that can't always get up here because of public transit. They can't always get to the office. So we send them literature, and they door knock whenever they can after work. We have a bunch of people with kids that take their kids canvassing. We have a kid-friendly office. But we have such a big smattering of people that come in and dedicate their time and their lives to this movement, because this means something to us. This matters to us. This is something that is at the core of us and so important to us, because this is a campaign that is built for people. We built it because we care about doing good work for people. We care about doing what's right for the people around us. And people have been feeling so helpless and lost, and they don't know where to go or how to make it better, that we've opened our doors and we've found people's strengths, and we've given them opportunities to do what they need to do to feel like they're taking action in a moment where it feels like they're doing nothing. And we've really tried to take everything we can and empower every volunteer that walks through our doors to be their best self and participate in this campaign in the way that brings them the most joy and that feeling of being relieved that they're actually moving forward.
That's so important in this time because, you know, the forces arrayed before us, what we've just seen with the Kavanaugh nomination and all of that, has, I think, some people fired up and some people overwhelmed and in despair. And so the kind of energy and hope you're describing is really, it's really a crucial part of it. Now I'm going to ask what I'm sure is the softball of all softball questions, which is, what is the difference between how you and how your opponent, you know, the seated Congressman Smith at this moment, there may be a different seated Congressman Smith after the midterms, and we hope for that. What is your different stances on health care?
Oh, boy, let me explain. I had to learn so much about health care over the course of this campaign. So I'm a firm believer in single-payer health care, and my incumbent, Adam Smith, he's signed on to Medicare for All, but he said publicly that he doesn't believe single payer is the only way forward. And he keeps throwing around this term, multi-payer. And he talks about how it works in France and Germany. And I have to follow him up and tell everyone he is gaslighting you. He is hoping you are not smart enough to realize what a multi-payer system is and why it works in France and Germany. And so I have to come out and tell people, I believe, you know, single-payer health care is just the government option. Everybody's covered, comes out of your paycheck, no more private insurance premiums. That's everybody in, nobody out. That's how that works. Everyone's covered. What multi-payer does is it uses government funds to force people to continue to buy private health insurance. And the reason it works in France and Germany is because of the way that they have set up the influence of corporate money in their elections, the influence of money in corporate policy, the lack of lobbyists and the influence of special interest groups, because the way our political system is set up now and the effect that corporate money has on it now, all it would do if we set up a multi-payer system is it would allow private corporations to come in and slowly chip away at it over time like they've been doing with the post office forever, because we do not have those protections of a full single-payer system. So he's hoping people don't look it up. So I went ahead and did all the research for everybody, but a commercial multi-payer system is what we have right now. What he's advocating for is just to put a government option in the market in the sense that that government option is forcing people to buy private health insurance. It is not a better system, and he's trying to trick people into thinking it is, which I think is despicable, because if you don't actually support single-payer, get off the bill to support single-payer that it took you 14 years to get onto in the first place.
What do you think your chances are in terms of defeating an incumbent? I mean, you know, that's egregious. I mean, that's just horrible. And healthcare is the single issue that is more important to more Americans all around the country than any other. And so, you know, playing this kind of two-faced shell game where you're, you know, lying about what your stance really is and misleading people, you know, who may feel, well, I'm not educated enough to, you know, understand what you're talking about, you know, that's really a very cynical kind of thing to do. Do you think people in District 9 are getting the message about that?
I really hope so. I try to bring it up all the time. We've done a really effective job, too, of using our social media outreach to try and target and get to a lot of places. So when I do videos where I talk about what the difference is, I try to target as many people as I can. So statistically, according to a bunch of studies that I've done, it's a 3% chance to be victorious over an incumbent. They have a 97% reelection rate. But the unpredictability factor here is 22 years of him, quote-unquote, leading from the shadows and him failing to take action on the things that matter to us. The corporate money isn't buying his action. They're buying his silence. And he who is silent in times of injustice sides with the oppressor. That's how I feel. But it has been silent. And after 22 years of this, and after Kavanaugh getting confirmed, after people are finally realizing that progressive values are important, I think this district is ready for change. And every time we knock on doors, we've gone to people that have my incumbent sign in their yard, and we've knocked on their doors. They just didn't know about our campaign. But once they do, they ask for a sign from us. It has happened multiple times. But I mean, folks are ready for change. We've had leadership in office that has failed to put forth or champion legislation that changes the lives of working people. And they're ready for someone who's going to stand up and take action. They're ready for somebody who's got a bit of fire in them. They're ready for somebody who is alight with this drive to get things done and who is tired of waiting around to take leadership from the shadows, whatever that means. He's been saying it for years and then suddenly stopped after I came along. But we're ready for something different. We're ready for somebody who's not afraid to take bold stances. We're ready for somebody that's not afraid to say the things that we're thinking, to talk about what we need, to refuse to compromise on the things that matter to us, because we can't go into these meetings willing to roll over. Then what's the point of going into the meeting if you're already rolling over on things? And it's time we had legislators in office who will stand fast for people, who will hold the line for folks that are marginalized and afraid and sick and dying and struggling under health care and homeless and facing food insecurity. We need somebody in office that is going to recognize those people and fight for them, not wait for somebody else to introduce a bill that might help in a minuscule way. We need big, bold action that is unapologetic, and this district deserves better.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think you're super articulate and very persuasive, and it's really exciting. You know, I sometimes feel, and I hope listeners to this show will get the sense as we, you know, hearing you, Sarah Smith, running in Washington State District 9, and in upcoming weeks on Connect the Dots, we'll hear from other candidates and journalists about who's running for office, how we can support them, and how we can actually, all of us as citizens, can make it a priority to support candidates like Sarah Smith, with whom I'm talking today, and the other ones upcoming on the show, to make a difference in the midterms, to make a difference in our country, rather than, you know, regarding our current to-do list and our habitual what we think we are, you know. And I'm leaving out of this people who have tiny infant children or invalids at home, you know, who obviously have those burdens to carry. But, you know, ordinary people, you know, just sending a postcard and telling people to vote, and you yourself just voting once a year, yes, it's very important to vote, but it's important to vote for the right candidate, and it's important to do something, you know, when you're heading down a road toward a teardown of all of the democratic contracts and agreements of this society, you know, to just cruise along with, you know, your pre-existing habits and program. You know, this is the time to make a change for all of us and to really get involved. People can actually go to your website and volunteer for you. They could volunteer, they could donate. They don't have to be, you know, in your district to do either. If people are interested, they could go to www.votesarahsmith.com. And Sarah is spelt the way it usually is, with an H. You know, if you're in the district, you can vote for Sarah. If you're not in the district, as I said at the beginning of the program, you know, we have to sort of step up and look at the overall outcome of these midterm elections. It's going to make a huge, big difference if the Democrats, with progressive edge new leaders coming in, you know, are in Congress and having that voice and that majority role, than if not. And so, you know, if anyone is concerned about what's going on in our society, as you certainly should be, if you care about people, if you care about the environment, if you care about democracy, you know, there's something you could do every single day to make a difference. And, you know, people can make calls for Sarah, you know, by going to her website and, you know, voting in the district and supporting, volunteering, and educating yourself about these positions otherwise. Now, let's just take a little shift here and talk about your position on foreign policy. Washington State is actually a locale, and people who don't live there may not be aware of it, where, you know, there are many major defense contractor corporations in that area. And there's also a lot of military activity in that area. And, you know, I'd love to, you know, to hear your views on U.S. foreign policy and also as it affects your district and your area.
Sure, of course. So I know progressives across the board get a little bit of a rap for not having strong foreign policy stances, but mine actually, I've been recognized as the only candidate who has a strong foreign policy platform, so I'm very proud of that. But I knew coming into this, foreign policy matters a lot for this district, and I also know that it's a strength of my incumbent, and so whenever I have a weakness like that, I go and I become an expert on it. That's just, I'm a big nerd. That's just what I do. But I mean, you know, foreign policy for me is extremely important. It's extremely important for everybody because in the year 2018, we are fastly becoming a globalized world, and foreign policy is what's going to determine our position on the world on that world stage. And I have a lot of pretty intense positions that are pretty detailed, so I'll try to give you the long and short of it. So I firmly believe in a humanitarian-based military. And what that means, because I've gotten that question a lot, is what does that mean? Is that means we're a military that goes to the bottom and helps the people who are suffering first. We make every diplomatic effort possible. We make every outreach effort possible to the people at the bottom to help encourage them as best they can to be as self-sufficient as they can, to help them develop as quickly as they can before we even think about violence and war. The weight of war on our shoulders should be so heavy to declare that we cannot sleep because we've done it. That is how I believe. That's how I believe. I've been protesting the same war for 17 years. Next year, it's old enough to vote. So this is a hugely personal problem for me. I have friends that have died. I have friends that are suffering from PTSD. And if you talk to them about their experience over there, they'll all tell you the same thing. All we're doing is we're guarding oil fields. We are sending naval fleets to protect oil tankers from the Middle East. This is what we're doing. We're using our taxpayer dollars to fund private wars is essentially what's going on. And we are overstretched. We are strapped for cash. We are inflating the military budget beyond what is absolutely necessary. And 60% of that budget is going to private military contractors. And actually, my incumbent's biggest donors are Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, and Boeing, who are all deeply invested in those wars over there. And Northrop Grumman and Raytheon posted billion-dollar spikes in revenue the day that we bombed Syria. And those are people that are in my incumbent's office at his door. And let me tell you something, they are not paying him to stop the wars. I can tell you that right now. But we need to take a humanitarian military approach to our foreign policy. Our goal should be to go in and help the people at the bottom. We should go in and help provide them with things like wind energy, teach them how to install solar, teach them how to install hydropower. We need to go in and build schools and help them get educated, train their teachers to teach these children. We need to go in and help them build up hospitals, help build up the communities that we have destroyed over time. Because if you want to talk about fighting the war on terrorism, you don't fight a bad idea with a worse idea. You fight a bad idea with a better idea. And right now all we're doing is we're bombing them, and that's our solution to the war on terror. But the war on terror is not just one that's physical. It's one that's also psychological, because they're relying on selling this narrative that the West is evil, that America is violent. And it's easy to point to bombed-out buildings and dead sons and daughters and say, that's America that did that to you, and galvanize those people and get them angry and recruit them. But if we are in those communities and we are helping them build wells for clean water, we are teaching them sustainable agriculture, we are helping them build up the rubble of the communities that we've bombed out, it's a lot harder to sell that narrative that we're evil if all we're doing is good in these communities. And we have the largest military in the world. We can do that. We don't have to go and bomb everybody all the time. We don't have to be in 11 interventionist wars. We don't have to be in regime changes, because in a globalizing world, regime changes become less and less common because we're more and more exposed to each other. And a lot of the things we need to do are we need to hold our allies accountable. When they are committing acts of atrocity, we need to hold them accountable and hold them to that standard. And we need to make sure that that humanitarian edge comes out in everything that we do. We need to be a leader. And the way you do that is you be a benevolent leader. You attract people by being a better option. You attract people by being a better role model, not a bully, which is what we are now.
Wow. That's really powerful. That makes a lot of sense. And I know what the comeback you know, from that strong and very clear position, which I think more people should be thinking about and talking about as you are, I really salute you from that. And now I'm going to ask you the question that I know you hear back from that. Jobs. But what about all the jobs in your area? Isn't it going to be alienating to the many people whose livelihoods depend upon the industries that you mentioned, who are donating to, you know, the entrenched candidate Adam Smith, who you were running against? I mean, you know, mm-hmm. what about that? Aren't people going to just, you know, run in droves and, you know, vote to secure their own jobs and, you know, come what may in the big picture?
We have been sold this story that in order for us to be prosperous, we have to have this economy of violence. This economy of war must exist for us to be successful. But all we're doing is we're building up our economic success on the dead bodies of other people. And we don't need to be those people. Our job should not rely on the murder and death of somebody else in order for us to have it. And when I talk about that, I have to explain to people, you know, these progressive policies are not compartmentalized. We're taught to compartmentalize legislation and treat it like it's all separate. But the fact is that it's not. It's completely intertwined. If we engage in a federal jobs guarantee and we start to establish hospitals in rural areas, we can hire folks from those areas and provide work for them. We can give them well-paid, meaningful work. We can hire on folks to do elder care, folks to do child care, to start building those social homes I talked about. When we invest in infrastructure, that's $4.6 trillion worth of jobs that we're going to need people directly employed in order to do, to build up our infrastructure. When we talk about a new Green Deal, we talk about investing in green energy. But that doesn't just mean that, you know, we're putting out aerospace engineers. Green energy has a place for aerospace. Alternate energy has a place for aerospace. We have a lot of opportunity for these folks who are involved in these industries to take those skills they've learned and apply them to helping other people, apply them to building up a better world, to building up a better America. We don't have to apply those skills just to a bomb and say that person is only good to create bombs. We can apply those skills to hydroelectric, to investing into looking into nuclear power and research and development. We can look at getting that person involved in medical research. We have opportunities to take those people and help them use their skills for the benefit of society rather than bombing of society. We just have been narrowed in our scope because we've been at war for so long that we can't imagine an economy that's uncoupled us from that violence. And now it's time to start, because we, in a rapidly globalizing world that's rapidly becoming connected, we can't just keep going into other countries and bowling them over and mowing them down and saying it's to create jobs. We have to find an alternative source to create meaningful work for people that doesn't rely on the blood in, seeping into the soil in other countries.
And are people hearing that message? I mean, do you have people who, you know, have been working in these industries who are kind of going, you know, who kind of on some level know this and are open to the change to be able to devote themselves, you know, through their own goodness to peacetime activity, you know, more peacetime and supportive community activities? I mean, are you getting a good
A lot of folks do. I mean, nobody, there's a small sector of the population that sleeps soundly when they know what their work is being used for. But a lot of people, when you give them the opportunity to, look, you can either help create this new kind of bullet that's going to mow down, you know, people of color faster when they're at a rally in a state or something like that, or you can go ahead and you can pioneer this piece of engineering equipment that's going to launch this satellite into space that's going to be able to help us track, you know, schools of fish that are endangered or something like that. People are almost always going to take the option that doesn't involve the death of their fellow man. We are wired to try and stop that from happening. That's, we don't want to kill people. Well, most people don't want to kill people. They would rather do something that benefits the world, that recognizes the significance of bigger problems like climate change and healthcare and education. They would rather do that than know that their work is being used for evil. I mean, you saw it all when the atom bomb was invented. All the scientists that were involved in that expressed their heavy heart and their weight and how horrible it was to know what their invention was used for. And I think that most people are like that. So if you give them an alternative, if you give them another route, if you uncover a path that they have been told doesn't exist their whole lives, they're going to want to take that other path, because that's the path of moral justice. It's making sure you're doing good work that's meaningful, not good work that's harmful. And when you present people with two options, that's the option they're going to take, is the meaningful, better work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that too, because, you know, it create, you know, here's the thing, what you're talking about too is by holding a certain kind of moral frame, you know, as your starting point, you're actually giving voters and people in your area and people throughout the country a way to realign what they're doing, you know, because mm-hmm. doing, you know, what we're talking about, which is, you know, working on weaponry that's killing people, or working for a company which, you know, with one of their divisions is working on weaponry that kills people. When there's a good-hearted person doing it in some way, even if they're kind of trying to just go along to get along, as so many people, you know, feel they need to do or need to do economically, you know, it creates cognitive dissonance. It creates a kind of you know, a lack of centeredness and wholeness and goodness, good feeling mm-hmm. within oneself. And that, you know, is actually the basis for a lot of the unrest that people feel, a lot of the addiction that goes on in this country and all of these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you're not pointing to the remedy of, you know, oh, you know, we meditate and then you'll feel better, but meanwhile you'll keep doing this. You're pointing to a social remedy that will help a lot of people, and you know, and help the whole country really, and help the whole world. If the United States is not going around, you know, using violence to act as the global policeman, when in fact, as you point out, it's really about protecting, you know, oil locales for mm-hmm. profit and exploitation. We're coming down to the last five or so minutes of the show. Can you let our listeners know any way that they can specifically help you in your campaign or help progressives in their own area? You know, what can people do? What would your counsel be?
Of course. So the biggest thing we need is we always need boots on the ground who can help canvass. We always need people on the phone who can help make phone calls, and that you can do from anywhere, actually. So if you go to votesarahsmith.com/call, you can actually log into our dialer from there and call from home, which I have a lot of people doing. But, you know, as a grassroots campaign, we have the same problem that every other grassroots campaign that's going to come on here will have, which is we always need donations. votesarahsmith.com/donate. I'm also on Twitter at sarahsmith2018, and I'm on Facebook at Sarah Smith for U.S. Congress. But you can find us there. Come and like and follow our page, see what we're up to, see what we're doing. We have a rally in Bellevue this upcoming weekend. I have a forum tomorrow. I have about six forums left to go to with my incumbent, which we'll be posting about and posting streams of whenever we can. So if you want to come and watch that way. but the other way that you can help get involved with my campaign is get involved with a progressive campaign in your area. Because when one progressive wins, all of us win. And whether it's at state, city, school board, federal level, whatever it is, get involved with a campaign. Even if it's just an hour a week where you go out and knock doors or pass out flyers, everything matters and everything helps. And the best way you can help yourself and you can help my campaign is by getting involved with another progressive campaign. Because it's about all of us, not just one of us. So if you want to check out my campaign specifically, votesarahsmith.com. You can check out our 23 policy pages of platform. And you can dial, you can vote and volunteer, you can donate, you can pledge to vote, you can do everything right from our website. But the other thing you can do is find another candidate in your area that you like and respect and get involved with them too.
Oh, well, thank you so much. How do people find, what's your recommendation for how people find other progressives in their area? Because, you know, people, a lot of people just kind of go, I'm going to Indivisible. And very often Indivisible is not functioning in a collaborative manner with progressives, let's be real. So where would you suggest people go? I mean, should they go to Our Revolution, Bernie Sanders, which the Bernie Sanders group organized? Is that a good place to go? Or where can people go to find progressives in their area?
I highly, highly, highly recommend Our Revolution. Most of their candidates are great. And then you also have Justice Democrats and Brand New Congress. Those are two other amazing progressive organizations. The other way you can do it, too, is contact your local elections office or go to their elections website, find out who's running, and just take the time to go through their platforms. And if you find someone whose ideology aligns with yours, who's got the right attitude, who you actually like and respect, and who you believe is the best representative of that policy, go help that person too. I independently research all my candidates in my state as well too, actually. I'm the person that takes 4 hours for mail-in voting. It's really annoying, but I like to be thoroughly researched. And if you take the time to just go pick something you're passionate about, read that candidate's platform, see if you can get involved. That's another way to locate good progressive candidates, because progressive legislation is going to ring to all of us when we read it.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are certain cardinal issues like health care for all. If you've got a candidate in your area or a, you know, an elected official in your area that's kind of waffling about that, or they're saying, oh, well, we'll look into it. I mean, looking into it means I'm not about it. Or, you know, similarly with money in politics, oh, it's terrible, let's do something many years from now. That's another way. You know, are they people who are saying, we're going in doing this, we are not taking corporate money, we are standing by this, you know, so these are other benchmarks, not what is called lip service, because unless you love to research and are online all the time, the chances are if somebody fobs you off with a brief phrase like, oh, I'd love to look into it, or we should do that one day, that means that it's on you to constantly follow up with them and figure out what they're up to. And a lot of people don't have the intestinal fortitude or the time to do that. And so that's another reason to really put your energy both in your area and nationally in candidates that are, you know, seizing the opportunity to take a real stand and make a real difference, and you know where they stand, so you're not really kind of having to go, well, did they actually do what they said, or they didn't? Oh, well, I only found that out when I read something about it 2 years later. Thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots. Sarah Smith, running for Congress, a member of what we hope will be the new Democratic Congress, elected after the midterms and coming in not a moment too soon in the new year. Here's to you and your hard work and your campaign and all the people working with you, as well as all of your progressive, you know, candidates and colleagues and friends and allies all throughout the United States. Thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And good luck. We're waiting for a win for you, and we're not waiting. You know, call up people. Go to her website. You can phone bank for Sarah wherever you are. Thank you, listeners, for being with us on today's Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time for the second stage of our month-long Get Active, Get Involved, the Progressive Sweep Through Congress. Be well.